Wonderful. Look, it is wonderful to be here. I am very much the warm-up act on this one. Dawn is really the expert on the beginning of life, and then tomorrow I'll be doing a little bit more on the assisted suicide and the end-of-life conversation. As Jeremy said, I'm the UK director. My background's in law, if that's helpful. It's all right. I have repented after my time as a barrister. It's fine. And I have a spiritual gift of arguing, which my wife can confirm. I'm still trying to find the text just to be sure about that. Turns out my daughter now has it, so my wife is very encouraged about that and likes to play us off. And then studied theology in Regent in Vancouver. And I come from a little place in Northern Ireland called Port Stewart, where there is a daughter convention right on my doorstep at the Keswick at Port Stewart. And for different people in the room, it's right round the corner from Royal Portrush, where the Open will be this week. And I'm excited to get into that later in the week too. So I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the stories, the cultural stories that shape how we got to the point of the vote that Jeremy was talking about. How do we get to those two votes? How do we end up as a culture where that became a reality to decriminalize abortion up to birth? And for the visual learners in the room, I have a game of Jenga with me. This is not a coincidence. Somebody didn't leave it behind or think you were in the kids' session. I'm going to use the Jenga tower, or tar, as we'd like to say in Northern Ireland, but I'll pretend I'm being, you know, culturally aware here. So we'll talk about the Jenga tower and what's going on. So down the bottom is what I would call, we're in a meaning crisis. And this is like the foundation layer of our tower. Oh, yes, and if we click, you might see that on the other screen. It's a kind of a PowerPoint and visual, but we're in a meaning crisis, and this bottom section is the kind of foundational stories that make up who we are, the general truths about the world that we have, the kind of basic beliefs that we used to share as a culture. And Jeremy, even as he was praying and introducing, talked about this kind of secular trend or tide. And as we have this kind of secular narrative, it said, look, there is no God, and it's begun to push out blocks from our story. Said, look, there is no overarching story that we all agree upon. As he bravely takes a block out here. We don't have an agreed set of rules as we have a conversation about some of these really tricky topics. We don't have an agreed set of stories and foundation stories about what it looks like. So we don't agree on the dignity of every human life. When does that actually begin? We're no longer agreed as a culture, and so we're continuing to pull blocks out of these stories. We don't have an agreed view on equality. We're real champions of equality when it suits, but then when it turns out that actually sex-selective abortion is happening, you're like, oh, well, let's just forget about that. It's still a woman's right to choose. We don't have an agreed stories on rights. Who has them? When do they begin? What happens when they come into conflict with each other? So we're seeing challenges on our and a meaning crisis on our foundation stories. Then as we move up into these blue blocks, this is more about the kind of relationship crisis that we're having as a culture. Essentially, this middle block is made up of the stories, that the communal stories that hold us together, the interrelationships that bind us together, how we treat one another, how we react and do relationships, live life in community with one another. And as we live in a culture that says, well, it's all about me. I decide what happens in my life. I need to be authentic or true to myself. We begin to pull blocks out of the communal story. We're saying, my relationships don't define me. I need to be free from all constraints. Nobody gets to tell me what to do. Not my parents, not schools, not religion. These voices shouldn't have a say in who I am, because it is all about me. It's to turn inward. We've rejected God and any overarching story. So who's in charge? Well, I am. I'm in charge of my life, and I need to be authentic to myself. And it actually leads to a kind of form of consumerism, where when it comes to relationships, it's about swiping right. Divorce is on the rise, because we're like, well, this is a contract, and I'm not getting what I want, and I need to be true to myself. And so I'll just move on. Oh, I'm not going to take that block. That's too risky right at the minute. This is where a visual goes wrong when you haven't prepped it all and like worked out. So here I'm cheating in a game of Jenga using two hands. I'm taking a high-risk strategy. So if you're listening on a tape, we have a very colorful Jenga block on a table here. It's very exciting. So we're saying, I've got no constraints. Nobody gets to tell me what to do. authenticity, I'm true to myself. Abortion isn't just like a kind of backstop or last resort. You have somebody like Lily Allen just last week saying, I've had 4 or 5 abortions, I can't actually remember, almost with a laugh in a podcast. And the interviewer says, oh yeah, I'm the same, I can't quite remember either. It's not a last resort anymore, it's something you can't even keep account of. Abortions are simply another product we consume coming from an abortion industry. Again, it's supply and demand. So we've got a meaning crisis on the foundation, we've got a relationship crisis, a kind of expressive individualism. We live in this individualistic culture all about me. And then we have a truth crisis. Some people might call that postmodernism. If you want to appear really smart, you talk about that. Fundamentally, that's about what is truth. We don't have an objective measure of what's true, what's good or what's bad, what's right or what's wrong, and so it's subjective. It comes down to what I decide. Jeremy has his truth, I have my truth. Dawn has her truth, I have my truth. And so you hear that kind of language, and what we end up with is a culture in which there are millions of personal truths bumping into each other. That's why the world feels this really kind of contested over women. You're like, there's not a single story, there's not even 1 or 2 big stories bumping into each other. There are literally millions. Every one of us as a story bumps into the next person, and there's no arbiter of truth. I have mine, you have yours, you have yours, you have yours. And so we're living in this crazy world, but there's no fixed order of things. There's no fixed pattern. There's no yardstick with which we can measure against. Say, oh, this is right, this is wrong. All meaning and truth is relativized to nothing more, basically, than personal taste. Well, it feels okay to me. Well, that doesn't feel good to me. And so we deconstruct the norms that were some of the kind of social conventions, the cultural customs, because people say, oh, those were keeping old power structures in place. We see this when it comes to sexuality. People want to be free, so they say, well, let's get rid of marriage and family because that constrains my freedom. So let's deconstruct them. Let's get rid of them. Let's undermine them because they're a bit of a pain. They limit my sexual freedoms. And so then we go to gender and gender stereotypes. So, well, let's get rid of gender stereotypes. Well, let's get rid of gender. Well, let's try and get rid of biological sex itself. You'd think that's one of the few things that'd be objectively true. Yeah, our culture's right now at a real wrestling point on that. That's a whole other seminar, of course. But it's this kind of desire to deconstruct or to queer almost everything, to kind of undermine it. So when it comes to the abortion conversation, nobody wants to talk about the fact that marriage and family are by far and away the best place to raise children on all measures and metrics, a stable two-parent household. We see the move to make abortion almost normal, where Lily Allen can almost joke about it, laugh about it. It's not an emergency or an extreme and an embarrassing thing. It's like, oh yeah, I've had a few, can't remember how many. The language is what? Reproductive rights, healthcare issue. It's a fetus until it's wanted. Somebody said, you never hear about the royal fetus. It's always the royal baby from the moment of conception, the moment we hear about it. And yet in every other conversation, it's a fetus. It's this bundle of cells, and Dawn will talk more about that. So we relativize truth, my truth, your truth. And it leads us to what I would describe then as a perma-crisis, a kind of permanent state of crisis. As these three combine in our massive game of Jenga, what you end up with, if you kept playing, we keep pulling blocks out, is this deeply unstable structure, all the weight at the top, it's all confused and chaotic at the top, and our cultural moment is contested. If you can click through a couple more and bring those up, that'd be great. It's contested, it's chaotic, and we're in this permanent state of crisis. The last one will come up. That's us in our kind of bits of the story. So it's contested because on one hand, you have people saying, actually, medically, we know a child can survive now before 24 weeks, maybe down to 22 weeks, maybe even to 20 weeks. People are talking about proposals to move the kind of threshold back, and yet then we get a move to decriminalize right up to birth. So the medical science is taking us in one direction, what we can do with the unborn child, and yet we shift in a different one. It's exhausting because there's these constant pushes. Every piece of legislation, somebody tries to tag on an amendment to liberalize and legalize abortion. And 3 days later, we have the move around assisted suicide. It feels this kind of overwhelming. People are like, oh my goodness. So if you ever played a game of Jenga, you know that moment we're in. It's kind of like, almost like I'm going, oh, don't touch that block. Don't pick that. It's like, don't even go near the table. The whole thing feels like it could fall over at any moment. That's where we are as a culture. It feels like the whole story could fall over because we've just pulled away at each layer of the foundations. And it's not just Christians who are feeling that. I don't know about you, but certainly my non-Christian friends are feeling the same. They're like, this is overwhelming. This is exhausting. I don't know how you raise kids if you don't have a foundational story, a community to do life with, and a personal relationship with Jesus. I don't know how they're doing it. In fact, my non-Christian friend takes my kids to church on a Sunday night because he's like, I just want my kids to have some value. I don't really like church. Kind of resents the Sunday lunch and getting dressed up and some of that. But he said, I'd like my kids in a kind of essentially a safe, sensible environment. So he takes my kids with his kids along to church, which is great on the journey in. So what comes next? What era are we in? We're in this chaotic stage. And some people are saying we're actually moving to an age. And it's not clear yet. Some suggesting it's almost like a post-human era. You may have heard a phrase like transhumanism. Where does AI and technology merge with what it is to be human? Some of that's positive in culture's view. This will be amazing, and technology is going to fix all the problems we have and the limitations, and apparently my sore ankle and things like that. That'll all be resolved with technology. And others are like, well, actually, no, it's going to decenter human beings. Human beings are almost like a parasite, not just in the womb, and Don will talk about that. They're a parasite in the whole of the climate. Human beings are the problem. Let's get rid of them. Let's go off to Mars and start a new colony. Anybody familiar with that idea from Elon Musk? You know, we're almost in a post-human age where humans are the problem. Humans are a challenge. And we can move beyond them. We can decenter them from the conversation. Or we can be liberated from our biology and the limitations of my body. Physical presence might even be optional. Is it possible that my or your sentience, your consciousness would live on in another space? Could it be uploaded into the cloud and downloaded into somebody else's body in time or into a robotic body? Like, this is where we're pushing to in the conversation. So if you think it's bad right now, well, where's it going to go to? But, because this feels like a depressing opening maybe, I think as the cultural stories fail, it is no coincidence that many of you have heard of the Quiet Revival Report and things like this, that we are seeing an increased interest in God, in the spiritual, in the transcendent, in something beyond. People are like, these stories aren't working. These stories aren't cutting it. Now, I could have told them that for a long time, but I think a lot more people that I'm talking to are saying the same. They're like, these stories are falling up short. It turns out when you get rid of God and you center everything on yourself, I can't bear the weight of all of my own existence. It doesn't work. When we get rid of truth, we reach a point where you can't have justice if nobody will tell you what the truth is anymore. And so we're in this chaotic period where everybody's feeling a bit exhausted and a bit overwhelmed. And in contrast to that, we do declare with Psalm 8, Lord, O Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. You have made your glory higher than the heavens. If we click on through, what are human beings that you think about them? What are human beings that you pay attention to them? You've made them a little lower than God and crowned them with glory and honor. This amazing reality jars with, but also appeals in our increasingly secular, individualized, and chaotic culture, our lost culture. And if we click to the next slide, we'll just very briefly touch on a couple of questions before I hand over to Dawn. So where are we in this conversation? Well, we're saying every single human being is a divine image bearer. They are made in the image of God. We are literally God's representatives here on earth. Whether you believe in Jesus, whether you follow him or not, everybody is made in the image of God. That's the high calling that we have. And that jars with a culture that isn't quite sure what to do with that. It says, I'm important in a meaning crisis, but it can't ground that. It can't tell me why. And where are we in that conversation? Well, we're living in God's good creation. But a world that doesn't acknowledge that God is good or God is true. And the reality, though we rarely would state it this bluntly, is that we are in a world that worships idols. Idols are parodies of the truth. And so the problem is, what is wrong in our conversation is, if that we are made in the image of God and we deny the God in whose image we are made, what's left? To deny God is to dehumanize. Because our very value, our very humanity is anchored in what it is, in who God is and the fact that we bear his image. And so what idols and idolatry do is that they dehumanize. And it's no surprise, in a sense, we reach this point in the conversation where we are dehumanizing the beginning of life, we are dehumanizing the end of life, and we are dehumanizing lots of sections in between. Tom Wright says, humans remain in bondage to their own gods who drag them into a variety of degrading and dehumanizing behaviors. And then what's the solution? Look, Don's going to get into practicalities, but the reason there's a picture of this lady holding like a fractured bit of mirror, as we would like to say, but I mean a reflective object. My English colleagues definitely give me a bit of a hard time about that. What's the solution? It's really easy to get into a culture war and say, look, culture's really bad, and we have all the answers, and we're really good. But the reality is this is God's good creation, and there are elements and glimmers on the truth all around us, and people are grabbing onto them. It's like a mirror that has been shattered, and people have taken a fragment and grabbed onto it, and in that they see a glimmer of the truth. They see a small reflection of themselves, but the harder they hold onto that, the more likely that is to cut their hands. It's not all bad. Some of their desires are good. They want relationships. They want dignity. They want meaning in this moment, but they're searching for it in the wrong places, and then they grab more tightly that bit of fractured mirror. They're cutting their hands. And what we want to do is say, how do we help you to take that and fit it back into the larger story of God's good and great and wonderful creation story? How do we replace those into the larger biblical story of what is good and true and beautiful? What does it mean to be made in the image of God? And so while it's rarely been so chaotic, and it can feel overwhelming at times, I think it's a really, really exciting time to be exploring this conversation of what it means to be human, both at the beginning of life and tomorrow more at the end of life. And with that, I will hand over to the main event that is Dawn.
Thank you, Peter. Can we go to the next slide, please? Before I begin, that was a lot that Peter just gave. And today we can't possibly touch on every aspect of the cultural and legal and moral quagmire that is abortion and women's rights. So I want us to start with just taking a breath. And Peter already mentioned Lily Allen. Jeremy mentioned vulnerable women. And we have those two aspects of this. There's a cultural war and an ideological battleground. And we have women who will appear to celebrate and be triumphant over the decriminalization of abortion right up to birth. And then we have other women, maybe women that we all know. Maybe it's part of the story of some of you, a pregnancy crisis. So undoubtedly, we have to hold on to our compassionate response. So where the world says it's about autonomy and freedom, that abortion unlimited is healthcare with no need to define the health need, where abortion says women's progress and freedom and equality is defined in and determined by the unlimited right to choose abortion, where do we as church start? Next slide, please. As both lives, we have a vision for a people and place that imagines better. We recognize and value the life and health of both lives in pregnancy. Now, you don't have to have a faith to believe that both lives in pregnancy matter, but today I'm talking to the church. So today we want to start actually at a point at which maybe the cultural conversation is different. Jeremy mentioned the dark week a couple of weeks ago, and we have seen a common consensus, a horror at that vote that would permit a woman to self-induce her own abortion up to birth. But the majority of the conversation pivoted around the point of viability, so sort of 24, 22 weeks. And in our conversation, even with people in the church, we see a conflict. When are we human? When does that life, pre-birth, matter? Lots of people have a but moment. I'm pro-life, but I wait for a point in time or a circumstance. So I want, in the context of the theme transformed, to really focus for the first couple of minutes on our hearts. What are our hearts telling us about both lives in pregnancy? When does unborn life matter? And what is God's heart? Next slide, please. You'll see here an ultrasound scan. You'll all be very familiar, I'm sure, with that. Beside that is a piece of art we commissioned to reflect God unborn. So that's where I want us to start. Theologically, when does God believe that both lives matter? When did Jesus come incarnate? We often think about it at Christmas, but the Word didn't become flesh at the point of his birth, which we celebrate at Christmas. God's unborn story began 9 months earlier, if we believe in the orthodoxy of Scripture. Jesus began his human story at exactly the same point in time that each of us did. He was conceived in his mother's womb. Next slide, please. So let's think about the development of every unborn baby, but thinking about it through Jesus. So Jesus was conceived by the Spirit. He was biologically and relationally, back to Peter's comment about relationships, biologically and relationally connected to his mother, fully human and fully divine. The word that spoke creation into being, voiceless, silent. The hands that in the end healed and touched weren't even formed yet. Do we believe this? At 3 weeks, Jesus' heart began to beat. 5 to 6 weeks, his brain started sending messages around his body. By 10 weeks, Jesus had nails and fingerprints. By 12 weeks, he was responding to touch and active in his mother's womb. Have you ever thought about the people and the circumstances around Jesus' conception? So if you think about Mary saying yes to God's invitation to her to be the mother of his son, she had a choice, and she said yes. When today the conversation is all about unlimited choice and unlimited control, and I control my outcome, and I can change my mind at any point, Mary said yes to God's invitation. She relinquished control, submitted to his plan for her, and risked even her life, depending on what Joseph would do. And at the point of time in which she went and met with her cousin Elizabeth, Jesus was in his first trimester of development. And the first person in Scripture to call Jesus Lord was Elizabeth. And Jesus wasn't even probably 12 weeks old yet, but he was recognized as her Lord. All of this matters. Joseph accepted his invitation to become the father of God the Son, Jesus, the earthly father. How many men today walk away, have been silenced, don't step up to their responsibility? Joseph did. At 19 weeks, Mary could feel Jesus moving and kicking in her tummy. And from that point on, he just develops and is becoming ready to be born. Do you see the difference? As church, have you ever heard a sermon on abortion? Is it talked about from the front? Is it talked about in your pews? One of our students said, everybody at university was talking about it, but not the Christians. We've been silenced. We're fearful. We've lost our confidence in the beauty of the gospel story that begins at this point with the redemption of all creation, the seed of the woman in his mother's womb, who then went on to save us all. Next slide, please. I think when we think about God unborn and Jesus' human story, it's our starting point. It influences our response to both lives, pre and post-birth. Both lives matter to God, and therefore they should matter to us. So let's think about the cultural context. Next slide, please. In a world that says it's all about freedom and has dehumanized unborn children up to birth, this quote, Jesus saves the world from a false freedom, from freedom as a euphemism for power, from freedom as justification for killing. Do you believe that abortion is a sin and a moral wrong? We can say that at the same time as holding in our hands and in our hearts a desire to respond with compassion and respect, and we give dignity even to people who don't agree with us. Next slide, please. The world pits women against their unborn children. Actually, it pits women against men and against our own bodies. That dehumanization that abortion sits within actually not only has dehumanized the unborn baby, but it has dehumanized us as women. And God's created design and order that gives women the potential uniquely to reproduce and bear and nurture life. A both lives perspective rejects the tug of war and says, what's good for one is good for the other. So our response is to see the reality of the woman in front of us, to see the reality of the crisis, but we know that we can't discount one life, so we need to work towards a solution for both. Next slide, please. In our response, we have a threefold, a Trinitarian response. We believe in laws that protect every human life, services that enable every human life to be chosen and to thrive together, and a culture that affirms every human life, regardless of circumstances, male or female, young or old, sick or well, disabled or not. Next slide. Nearly 60 years of abortion choice in law and policy. You maybe hear pro-choice activists and advocates or pro-abortion advocates say that legalizing abortion doesn't make a difference to abortion rates. It just means they're safe. Well, anybody who looks at government statistics knows that that's frankly a lie. 57 years later, abortion rates are the highest they have ever been. The most recent year is 2022. Predictions for 2023 put that up closer to 300,000. Can you even comprehend in 1 year 300,000 terminations of pregnancy? That's 300,000 women, 300,000 men who were and are no longer mothers and fathers. Next slide, please. 98% of abortions are healthy women, physically healthy women, terminating physically healthy babies. It's effectively abortion on request. Next slide, please. It was already mentioned about repeat abortions in the context of Lily Allen's interview with Makita. But over 40% of abortions are now repeat. It's not a pro-life myth to say that many women are using abortion as a form of contraceptive. And actually, when you look at the abortion providers' websites, the next generation of abortion care is the redefinition of contraceptives so that abortion pills are available to take daily, weekly, monthly, different variations over the counter. So redefining contraception to include abortion. And for so many of us in the church, we don't have the conversation about when life begins and matters, about what contraception does, how we plan our families, what is good reproductive care and what is not. Has the church become complicit in our silence to the dehumanization of unborn lives and the weakening of an understanding of biology and medical science? When it comes to disability, stats vary. Between 7 and 9 out of 10 babies diagnosed in the womb with Down syndrome are terminated. I was talking recently to a maternal mental health midwife. And this is where I think the church can be and is being, even without realizing it, so countercultural. Where abortion has become the default for early pregnancy crisis, in later pregnancy, and we'll talk a bit more about that tomorrow, and termination for medical reasons, abortion has also become the presumed and assumed best care. And we will talk about it tomorrow, but in the context of today and the church and how we model God's heart, this midwife said to me that because so many babies with disabilities are now terminated, very many people outside of church, in society, actually don't know anybody anymore with a disability And she said specifically about Down syndrome and how, as a maternal mental health midwife, she will often say to mummies who've been diagnosed or their baby has been diagnosed with a disability to connect into a local church, because actually church is one of the few places left where there are people with disabilities. And particularly when it comes to a newborn baby, this midwife said to me that for those mummies, one of the comments was, there, my baby was seen as a person, not as a disability. That's church, intergenerational, multigenerational, male and female, young and old, doing family and modeling God's heart in the church and outside of the church. Both lives matter in every pregnancy. Thank you. We need the government. The government have voted to decriminalise self-induced abortion up to birth, and we'll see how that bill proceeds through Westminster. And I've already said that laws do matter, laws that restrict abortion, save lives, laws that permit abortion lead to increased terminations of pregnancy. So laws do matter. The government has a role to play, even if in law they have said abortion is unlimited. They have a role to play in statutory care packages. But abortion is seen just as a healthcare matter. So abortion is siloed as a health procedure. And lots of those connected issues, with the vast majority of abortions being a lack of socioeconomic capital, if you like, no emotional support, material support, financial needs. Health and social care, when it comes to pregnancy crisis, should be connected. So the family hubs that have been announced for England, we think that's a great opportunity in the place of the family hub to connect the conversation around pregnancy crisis. Why is there a crisis? What can we do to help you? What can the government help provide? What benefits are available? Where are the food banks? Where are the emotional supports? Of course, third sector providers have a role to play. But for the most part, actually, coming back to the previous slide, please, for church. Church and friends and family are probably some of the most significant contributors to this conversation. The most at-risk women are single and young. 82% of abortions are for women whose marital status is given as single. And they're in their early to mid-20s. They don't have an emotional resource, financial resource, to continue in their pregnancy. The most at-risk pregnancies, proportionally, are those babies unborn that are disabled or ill. But imagine if, regardless of what the government does, regardless of what statutory care packages there are, the church stepped up, talked about it, talked about God's heart for both lives from conception, and modeled that in helping women live and do life with their babies. And families, I have a friend who loves Jesus, said to me, she's pro-life, but I wouldn't want my daughter's life ruined. There are a number of stories on our website, and it's church-going families who chose the private, secret abortion over the public shame, over maybe their daughter's life and projected career path and future opportunities being ruined. As I look out at all of you, I am very aware I don't know your backstories, and I am going to draw this to a close because we want to have a time for Q&A and discussion. I don't know what you know and who you know who may have faced pregnancy crisis or abortion, or for what reason. And I hope that nothing that has been said today has been offensive, and I would ask you to come and speak to me at the end if that's the case. But I hope that what I've done is start to maybe peel apart the silence, the fear, the resistance, to draw attention to the fact that to some degree, within a system that provides government-funded abortions and actually promotes them within the health system, we all as taxpayers are part of the system. How can we be part of the solution as well? And frankly, if the church isn't talking about the value of life from conception more loudly, boldly, with compassion, who is going to? Next slide, please. These are some of the service providers that we signpost to on our website. All of the information and more information is in the booklets that I've laid out on the seats. And on our website, you'll see God Unborn is a project. We look at the 9 months between the angel and the manger. We look at Mary's yes and Joseph's yes, the people and circumstances. I'd love you to take the time to read, to have a look. But for now, I'm going to take some questions. I'm just going to throw it open. I'd ask us all to be respectful because we don't know who's in the room. Go ahead.
Oh. Sorry, I'm going to have a mic here. Please say your question into the mic as clearly as you can. Thank you.
I know you've only got so long that you had to talk, but something that I think should be mentioned in counselling is that if a woman who has a female who has an unwanted pregnancy goes to full term, there are more people that want to adopt than there are babies available to adopt. So that is a possible answer to an unwanted pregnancy.
Thank you. And you're perfectly correct that whether it's in counselling sessions or on the government website, whether it's the British Pregnancy Advisory Service or the NHS, they'll make clear to women that you have three legal pathways open to you. You can continue to birth and parent, you can have an abortion, or you can look at placing your baby for adoption. And actually, we've been recently having conversations with some adoption teams to understand better what that looks like. But in the context of pregnancy crisis, although that's a legal choice, the numbers of babies being voluntarily relinquished in the context of a pregnancy crisis are pretty much single digit. Tiny numbers. Most children who are being adopted are older. It's not within the context of a pregnancy crisis choice being made. And I think that is an aspect of the poor provision of time and space for a woman to discuss more fully what her options are. I think too many women don't understand what abortion is and does. They don't understand maybe the stage of pregnancy. And in the context of pills by post, they can phone up. They don't need to see a GP. They don't need to go to anybody else. They can just phone, order abortion pills, get them posted out and take them without actually talking to anybody. So adoption's an important part of the conversation, but unfortunately in the context of pregnancy crisis, it's not a reality anymore. But we can change that.
One of the arguments I've heard non-Christians kind of argue towards Christians is that we focus far too much on abortion and not on foster care. And why are there children in the UK, the US, that need foster care and churches aren't stepping up to do that? Why are we focused on unborn life more than current birthed life?
And again, I think that's it's sort of an unfair question in that, say, if families look at preventing family breakdown and children going into care, and Home for Good, who again were birthed through the EA, are really charging the church to step into that space of adoption and fostering. So we shouldn't be pitting those two needs against one another. More children. And it is true, if one family, I think it still remains, from every church, fostered or adopted, there'd be no children in the care system. But again, pregnancy crisis is a whole other area. And in Northern Ireland, before the law changed, The inference is nearly, well, if you provide abortion, fewer children will be in care. But actually, we didn't see that. It's not the case.
Thank you. I would like to know what is the best way that we can support our doctors, because they have legal obligations. There used to be conscience clauses and things like that. But how can we support our Christian doctors through this time of great change at both ends of the spectrum? Thank you.
Thank you. There are still conscience protections. You're right that they're under attack. I've been in rooms with abortion activists where they want them removed completely. They actually want naming and shaming. I've seen some activists talk about putting up a list, a public list, of doctors and nurses who are currently opting out of abortion care. I would say if there's anyone here within the room who's a nurse or a midwife or doctor, the Christian Medical Fellowship, we work closely with them in a number of different spaces, along with some of these providers. And I would say, as a medic or a healthcare worker, talk to the Christian Medical Fellowship, understand more fully with them the protections that you do have, conscience protections, and that will help you articulate them more clearly, maybe to your line manager. That would be the advice that we've been given. Have the conversation, understand where your limits are, and articulate those clearly, and you have a right to step back from being hands-on involved.
On the assisted suicide, might pick it up a bit more tomorrow, but there again, there is a conscience clause for medics. But no, this legislation is very much more in the draft sense. One of the more problematic bits is that hospices can't opt out, and care homes in general. So while individual medical practitioners can, the care home or even a group of care homes can't. I just honestly don't quite understand why they were so adamant not to allow that, because it means entire organizations wanted to be able to say, well, we don't provide that service, so if your relative or you come here, you're clearly outside of that bit of the system and you'd have to be moved if at any point something. They haven't done that. But as I say, that legislation is ongoing. So individual medics are protected in that. And probably similarly to abortion and all, GPs are less on the front line of that conversation because people tend more to go direct to the service provider. I mean, it really is an industry, I would say, and similarly, that's what we expect to happen with the assisted suicide if it goes ahead. That said, they can be creative. People still do come to them. GPs in particular, probably, and medics do have a significant amount of freedom depending on how their practice is set up, and they definitely have the conscience protection, but CMF are great in that. We'll have to see how the assisted suicide bit plays out, because that legislation has to go through the Lords. Will it fully pass, and what will all the protections look like?
And if we could bring it back maybe to start of life but end of the pregnancy for terminations for medical reasons, that's more when nurses and doctors would be hands-on involved. We've talked with a number of midwives who are Christians but have drawn lines in different places. So one midwife who won't be involved at all, another couple of midwives I've spoken to recently who won't be part of the feticide or the induction, but they will be part of the labour, and because they want to be present in the room to provide best care for mum and a baby whose life has been ended but they want to give dignity to. So we don't take a line, but we do say, you know, conscience is important and to understand what rights you have.
Could I just ask before the next question, of us here, how many of us work in the medical profession? Just a show of hands. Who works in the medical profession here? Very interesting. There's a smattering around. Thank you. Right, next question.
Thank you very much for the presentations, both parts of it. I was interested in what you said about people being silenced, particularly men. I experience a sort of reluctance to speak, because often it's kind of even assumed that this is the position now, no one is going to challenge this, and even the suggestion that you might want to contribute a different view, it's difficult, isn't it?
Would
you like to say a bit more about that?
Certainly I can. If I give two sort of stories very briefly. We did an event at one stage and a church leader came up to me at the end. He works in third level education, and a young male student had come to him heartbroken. His girlfriend had told him she was pregnant. He felt, it's not my place to say anything. It's her body, her choice. He said, you can do what you think is best. And she terminated. And he was left devastated, feeling, if I had showed some more support, would that have made a difference? And recognized very strongly that that was his baby. So he felt he'd let her down and his own unborn child down. And if I make it personal, I had a pregnancy crisis at university. I'm from Northern Ireland, but I was across the water, so abortion was readily available. Perhaps coming from Northern Ireland, where it wasn't legal, and coming from a Christian family, I would say to any man who feels it's not his place, you're a son, you're a partner, and if there's a pregnancy involved and it's your baby, you are already a father. You have a voice and you should step up. So in my own context, my then boyfriend, now my husband, stepped up. Really bad timing for both of us at that stage of life. But he stepped up for his baby and me. And both of our fathers stepped up and supported us. And that made all the difference. And if 82% of abortions are women whose marital status is given as single, where are the men? Now, we need to be responsible with our behavior, but every man in this room has as much a voice in this as every woman, I believe.
Thank you. As a past chairman of the Christian Medical Fellowship, thank you for the mention. It's very important that Christians work together on this. And one of the things we've been very careful of in CMF is to have information and literature available. So on our website, there is a tremendous amount of help there. And as you say, there is a lot of support available to both midwives and doctors. One thing that puzzles me as a member of the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists that was set up to look after women in pregnancy and to look after their babies is now one of the leading proponents for abortion. And I cannot understand it. I've written to the president when she was, two or three presidents ago to inquire why she'd become so pro-abortion when she'd actually come into prominence for helping women who were having miscarriages, and had no reply. But now the Royal College of Obstetricians is so much in favour of abortion, I cannot comprehend it. But we need to work together on this. And you're right, men should have a voice. They have a voice. I don't ever remember seeing a man being involved in an abortion clinic in my hospital.
Thank you. Celia Wyatt did a lecture here, is it 2 years ago?
That's right, yeah.
And I know John's here this morning at another seminar, but I did. I was on John and Tim Wyatt's Matters of Life and Death podcast a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking about the whole backstory, how have we got to where we've got, and John raised the point of the conflict of interests. So how many senior medics within the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists are also senior within the abortion providers. So Dr. Jonathan Lord, you'll often see quoted in the media as an obstetrician gynecologist, and they'll cite his role within the Royal College, but they'll fail to mention he's the medical director at Mary Stopes. And there's a number of crossovers. So there's definitely a conflict of interest, and it's definitely become the case that, as John would say, in one room, the baby's wanted, so every effort is put into saving their life, and in another room, the baby's not wanted and can be terminated up to birth.
And I really just jumped up on that unity point. I just really want to stress how much work goes on behind the scenes across organizations working together. CMF's medical expertise and Mark Pickering and others is incredibly important to us. We have some policy links. There are other groups that are doing work on the ground more, and it's the coordination of that that makes an impact. So this can feel overwhelming, and parts of this conversation are depressing because of what's involved, the numbers that Dawn was saying. But there is also considerable encouragement. There is considerable work going on. There are ways in which the church is uniting on this and a number of other issues. And I also think there's really interesting conversations beginning to happen. It's almost like our culture has reached a point of like, oh, this is getting just too far at every level. And But I want to encourage about the unity piece behind the churches working together at events like this, but across the board and behind the scenes, there's incredible collaboration.
And if I just jump in very quickly to that point, if there is anyone here who's in the area of service provision or a church leader, I currently chair the steering group of what's called the Church's Pregnancy Crisis Roundtable, and that's CMF, PCN, the Pregnancy Centres Network, Choices Islington that Celia Wyatt helped found, CARE, Christian Action Research Education. I'm sure there's others that I can't think right now, but we're all sitting in that group together. And we hold two roundtables a year. The next one is in September. If there's a service provider or church leader who'd be interested, or anyone, please do speak to me at the end. And it's not a publicly advertised event, but we'd be very happy to share the details with you.
First of all, thank you both very much for your presentation. I think you've been very good and very clear why we've had the building blocks and then your input. It seems to me that part of the problem when it comes to action is that people have got their hands on policy, are largely represented by the group at the top of the Jenga tower, who are very confused and who think that the most important philosophical principle to stick with is ethical autonomy, my right to make my choice. In politics, they incline to think of it as libertarian. And I wonder, I was a member of the House of Lords, and I was shocked by the number of people who I know didn't like the direction of travel around some of these ethical issues, but who kept silent, men and women, as a matter of fact. And there's something in all this, and I'm sure you've been on the receiving end of this, is that courage is a really important thing, not least in the arena of policy making. And I just pray now, I'm not a member now, but I pray that, I mean, I'm very proud of the fact that when I made my speech on assisted dying, I got hissed by the opposition when I walked out of the chamber. It's one of the kindest things that's ever happened to me. But, I just wonder if you'd like to comment into all that area, because it seems to me that it's a bit difficult to have confidence in our policymakers at the moment. I'm not making a political comment in that. I think it's just that a lot of them are the children of this cultural soup that we've somehow ended up in.
I think there's so much, and thank you for that. I think if we only... So both lives sits within the EA. We're not a service provider. So we're part of the advocacy team, so we do the policy engagement. If that was all we did, I think I'd give up, because it's such a difficult space, and the trajectory that we're on in a policy sense seems to be set. And whether it's the most recent conversations in the House of Commons or when Northern Ireland's legislation was changed in 2019, the weight of support for the decriminalisation of abortion, the toxicity of the conversation, the fear among so many people to say anything different, it would just make you feel like you may pack up and go home. But actually, that's where the heart transformation, I believe in the power of prayer. It is a top-down. We don't give up. We still have those relations. We seek to make new relations with politicians and their advisors. But it's also a bottom-up. So it's a top-down transformation that we need, and it's a bottom-up transformation. And that's where every single person in this room can't abdicate responsibility and say, well, it's up to the legislators and policymakers, because all of it together, the whole system, then will affect culture change, and that's what really matters.
If I can finish then with the story, a very bizarre conversation with Martin McGuinness in Northern Ireland when he was the Deputy First Minister about abortion, and we were trying to understand each other a little better, and I said basically, look, Sinn Féin, his party, had said they were in favour of same-sex marriage but still opposed to abortion, and I said, I think you're going to go pro-abortion, and he was really quite cross with me, and not, we weren't friends, but we'd spoken quite a number of times. But it was one of the few times I'd seen him really angry, and he just was adamant they weren't going to change on abortion, and he couldn't understand. I said, but I don't understand why you've said same-sex marriage is fine, and I know there's people in your party pushing for abortion, and I believe that, because there's no coherent framework as to why you would oppose abortion. it's essentially an old carryover from Catholic social teaching, I think, that's in the background of your party. And he was really crossing right out and basically said over my dead body, which proved to be true. It was only after he died it passed, but it was clearly coming, but he couldn't. I just thought it was totally incoherent and he couldn't see it. And I think we're seeing that with a lot of policymakers. There's a total incoherence in how they engage in this. The only thing I think that's positive in that is it's beginning to be exposed. People are going, actually, this doesn't make sense. I don't understand what people are voting for, and there's a total incoherence as to the way that they're doing it. And I am a more positive kind of in my perspective on this, in that where this quiet revival and some of the stuff that we're seeing around it, this interest is, people are saying, this isn't cutting it, this isn't working, and there is an increased interest. I'm not saying that's across the board, and I'm not saying it's a revival. That language has to be caveated. But the uptick is significant, particularly amongst young men. So younger people and men, the two things that we were struggling with in the church. So I am very positive. Now, that has a whole load of challenges. I'm not naive. There are political views that are leading the men. They're coming in through like a Jordan Peterson or a Joe Rogan, and they have a whole set of views with that. And there are lots of people coming in, and the church isn't necessarily their primary lens through whom they encounter Jesus. They did that on their own or through an experience, and then they're coming. Loads of challenges, but it's an incredibly exciting time, I think, to be engaged in these conversations. And with my last 30 seconds, I will say that both Don and I are here on behalf of Evangelical Alliance. If you are interested, you can come along, find out more about us. I have some forums. It's £3 a month to be a member. We'd love to give you a free gift. That's what allows us to do both of our bits of work, and our work is across uniting the church and then having voice in the corridors of power. And one of the reasons that's impactful for us is that we have 27,000 individual members and 3,000 churches, and political parties know that membership's hard. It's not a Facebook group. It's not three or four people in a room coming up with a campaign. When we go in and say we represent literally tens of thousands of members, that is a shift in the conversation with policymakers, hard as it is sometimes to convince them of the argument. But that's the space we get to occupy, so we'd love you. If you want to find out more, do come and chat to either Don or myself. It's been wonderful to be here. Thank you for your time.